Sudavene noi șave. Sudavene noi șave, sare. Sudavene noi șave. Și tu noi chem grai șerți de la bate prim și de la hei, 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 hei. Ai naraș mai de rău, un ai naraș este rău, un ai nără balăgou. Zahari, pămăși mai de la hei.
Thank you. لن فرزوینکن اوی اوبلی فرزوینکن اوی اوبلی نم بیخوی خاراین این شپیل پرگیم بیروی دوگلی نم بیخوی خاراین این شپیل پرگیم بیروی دوگلی اولی اولی فیلتر لکل فنیر زندو اولی فیلتریلی مستوی ریزا کارو شپیل Mein großer Kopf, sie stirbt aus Eichen Spiel, sie stirbt aus Eichen Spiel. Meine Schome ist noch jung, wie trinkt mit Jorn viel. Meine Schome ist noch jung, wie trinkt mit Jorn viel. Ei, hole, hole, der Elefant von mir sind noch hier. Der alte Frühling ist mein Ende, dieser ganzen Spiel. Meine Schome ist noch jung und geht von Bergschaft aus, und geht von Bergschaft aus. Ach, wie gern will sie hier von Alten zu Farois, ach, wie gern will sie hier von Alten zu Farois. Ohne, ohne, der Lachter von mir und von mir, weil ich mit Frieden ist, wenn der Rieser kann zu springen. Spielt das liebe Kinderlach, versäumten euch, Versäumtchen oi Bubli, weil der Frühling eckt sich bald mit ihm das Herz verglich, weil der Frühling eckt sich bald mit ihm das Herz verglich. Oi, 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 Kinderlach, komm an, wir sind noch hin, weil mit Frühling ist der Winter in der ganzen Spring. Oi!
Oi! Okay, going backwards from the last one you were listening to, Juliet, Juliet, Kinderlach. And anyone out there who may speak Yiddish and might have a translation for us, for me, you can write to me at MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Please do. That, okay, again, that last one, Juliet, Juliet, Kinderlech. Kinder obviously means child something or other. And before that, you heard Tumbalalaika. Sounds like a Russian instrument. Tumbalalaika. Rezel. Achazen oif Shabbos. And that's the one we began with. Yes. Achazen oif Shabbos. Rezel. Tumbalalaika. And Juliet Kinderlich. Alrighty. Let's get back to the reading. And we are reading from The Origin of the Palestine-Israel Conflict. Third edition. This version of that, of many varieties of such explanatory booklets, attempts at rendering the actual history of what happens, was published by Jews for Justice in the Middle East and distributed by If Americans Knew. Now, where the heck was I? Oh yeah, I was going to begin page 14. New section here now, jump ahead from 1948 or so, some 19 years into their future, the 1967 war and Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. What was that really all about? Continuing with this question, statement, or proposition first, and then an answer to that in this highly edited... I'm just looking at something on my computer screen here. You know, clearly, as I believe I said last time and I began reading this, this is a highly edited compilation taking posed posited answers to these questions from a great many different sources, which is a healthy thing. That's fundamentally the way I do my program, is get information from all kinds of sources, even occasionally Israeli or Zionist forces. What's fascinating is how telling and how incriminating many of those Zionists' quotations and sources are. Okay, again, the 1967 war and Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. question or supposition made first, and then the answer. Continuing with that format. Did the Egyptians actually start the 1967 war as Israel originally claimed? Quote, in June 1967, we again had a choice. The Egyptian army concentrations in the Sinai approaches do not prove that Nasser was really about to attack us. We must be honest with ourselves. We decided to attack him. End quote. That one from Menachem Begin, Menachem Begin, who was the leader of one of those 1948 militant Zionist Jewish brigades, and later became prime minister, leader of the Israeli state. I'm going to read that again because it's fundamentally important. Did the Egyptians actually start the 67 war as Israel originally claimed? Quote, in June 1967, this is the words of Menachem Begin, in June 67, we again had a choice. The Egyptian army concentrations in the Sinai approaches do not prove that Nasser was really about to attack us. We must be honest with ourselves. We decided to attack him. End quote. Menachem Begin quoted in Noam Chomsky's The Fateful Triangle. Was the 1967 war defensive? I almost said divisive, but no. Was the 67 war defensive, as in defensive of Israel? Quote, I do not think Nasser wanted war. The two divisions he sent to the Sinai would not have been sufficient to launch an offensive war. He knew it, and we knew it. Yitzhak Rabin, Israel's chief of staff in Le Monde, February 28, 1968. And again, Yitzhak Rabin, Israel's chief of staff in the 67 war, also later became head of state for the Jewish state of Israel. Here's another answer to that defensive question. Quote, it was not fear of Egypt or the closure of the Straits of Tehran that motivated the Israeli cabinet's decision to go to war. It was the general's confidence that victory would be theirs and the need to prove to the Arabs that Israel could not be intimidated. End quote. Donald Neff, Warriors for Jerusalem. Moshe Dayan posthumously speaks out on the Golan Heights. Moshe Dayan, the celebrated commander who was defense minister in 1967, gave the order to conquer the Golan. Note they use the word conquer here. Dayan gave the order to conquer the Golan. Said many of the firefights with the Syrians were deliberately provoked by Israel and the kibbutz residents, who pressed the government to take the Golan Heights, did so less for security than for the farmland. Dayan stated, they didn't even try to hide their greed for that land. We would send a tractor to plow some area where it wasn't possible to do anything in the demilitarized area and knew in advance that the Syrians would start to shoot. Provocation there, see? If they didn't shoot, we would tell the tractor to advance further. Until in the end, the Syrians would get annoyed and shoot. And then we would use artillery and later the Air Force also. And that's how it was. The Syrians on the fourth day of the war were not a threat to us. End quote. The New York Times, May 11, 1997. Again, quoting Israeli Minister of Defense Moshe Dayan, who was a general in the 48 so-called War of Independence for Israel. Now, the history of Israeli expansionism, or on the history of Israeli expansionism. The acceptance of partition does not commit us to renounce Transjordan. One does not demand from anybody to give up his vision. We shall accept a state in the boundaries fixed today, but the boundaries of Zionist aspirations are the concern of the Jewish people, and no external factor will be able to limit them. End quote. David Ben-Gurion in 1936, way back in 1936, folks, quoted in Noam Chomsky, The Fateful Triangle. What did I say a little earlier about how utterly telling and brutally honest some of those Zionist sources are on the matter of expansionism continued. Quote, the main danger which Israel, as a Jewish state, poses to its own people, to other Jews, and to its neighbors, is its ideologically motivated pursuit of territorial expansion and the inevitable series of wars resulting from this aim. No Zionist politician has ever repudiated Ben-Gurion's idea that Israeli policies must be based, within the limits of practical considerations, on the restoration of the biblical borders as the borders of the Jewish state. That was said by Israeli professor Israel Shahak. Jewish history, Jewish religion, the weight of 3,000 years. Just so I understand, I'm going to reread that last sentence. No Zionist politician has ever repudiated Ben-Gurion's idea that Israeli policies must be based within the limits of practical considerations on the restoration of the biblical borders as the borders of the Jewish state. Here's another item on the topic of expansionism. In Israeli Prime Minister Moshe Sharet's personal diaries, there is an excerpt from May of 1955 in which he quotes Moshe Dayan as follows. Israel must see the sword as the main, if not the only, instrument with which to keep its morale high and to retain its moral tension. Toward this end, it must invent dangers. And to do this, it must adopt the method of provocation and revenge. And above all, let us hope for a new war with the Arab countries. That's what he says here, folks. And above all, let us hope for a new war with the Arab countries so that we may finally get rid of our troubles and acquire our space, end quote. Quoted from Israeli Prime Minister Moshe Sharet in Livia Rokach, Israel's Sacred Terrorism. Some of these sources I've heard of before, some I have not. I believe most of them I have heard of or come across. My head is almost spinning. Just even though a lot of the stuff I knew to begin with, I still learn new things. And as I read about the utter audacity and utterly blatant warrior mentality of the Zionists, it just makes my head spin, makes me wonder what's happened to reality. And a lot of the stuff is at least 70 years or more older. I mean, up to 70 years or more. Okay. But wasn't the occupation of Arab lands necessary to protect Israel's security? Remember, now we're talking about the 67 war in which the West Bank and Gaza were taken. Quote, Senator J. William Fulbright proposed in 1970 that America should guarantee Israel security in a formal treaty, protecting her with armed forces if necessary. In return, Israel would retire to the borders of 1967. The UN Security Council would guarantee this arrangement and thereby bring the Soviet Union, then a supplier of arms and political aid to the Arabs, into compliance. As Israeli troops were withdrawn from the Golan Heights, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank, they would be replaced by a UN peacekeeping force. Israel would agree to accept a certain number of Palestinians, and the rest would be settled in a Palestinian state outside of Israel. Continuing with the quote, the plan drew favorable editorial support in the United States. The proposal, however, was flatly rejected by Israel. The whole affair disgusted Fulbright, writes his biographer Randall Woods. The Israelis, and Woods continued to say, the Israelis were not even willing to act in their own self-interest, end quote. This was stated by Alan Brownfield in Issues of the American Council for Judaism, Fall 1997. American Council for Judaism. Editor's note, this was one of many such proposals. What happened after the 1967 war ended? Quote, in violation of international law, Israel has confiscated over 52% of the land in West Bank and 30% of the Gaza Strip for military use or for settlement by Jewish civilians. 52% in the West Bank, 30% in the Gaza Strip. From 1967 to 1982, Israel's military government demolished 1,338 Palestinian homes on the West Bank. Over this period, more than 300,000 Palestinians were detained without trial for various periods by Israeli security forces. From Intifada, the Palestinian Uprising Against Israeli Occupation, edited by Lachman and Bainan. I believe this refers to Joel Bainan, who also was one of the speakers at the conference last month, a couple of weeks ago, in Santa Cruz. Let me see now. We've got a ways to go here. We have roughly perhaps 20 minutes left in this program. Okay. It's important for me to get a handle on how much longer. Let's see. What's the next section here? World opinion on the legality of Israeli control of the West Bank and Gaza. Here's a quotation from John Quigley, who wrote Palestine and Israel, A Challenge to Justice. Under the UN Charter, there can lawfully be no territorial gains from war, even by a state acting in self-defense, under the United Nations Charter. The response of other states to Israel's occupation shows a virtually unanimous opinion that even if Israel's action was defensive, its retention of the West Bank and Gaza Strip was not. The UN General Assembly characterized Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza as a denial of self-determination and hence a, quote, serious and increasing threat to international peace and security, end subquote, end quote, John Quigley. And, okay, let me just pause here. Pause my machine, I mean. Okay, some 20 minutes left. Examples of the effects of Israeli occupation. This was written by Betty Jane Bailey in The Link, December 1996. A study of students at Bethlehem University reported by the Coordinating Committee of International Non-Governmental Organizations, NGOs, in Jerusalem showed that many families frequently go 5 days a week without running water. The study goes further to report that water quotas restrict usage by Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza, while Israeli settlers have almost unlimited amounts. A summer trip to a Jewish settlement on the edge of the Judean desert, less than 5 miles from Bethlehem, confirmed this water inequity for us. While Bethlehemites were buying water from tank trucks at highly inflated rates, Bethlehemites, referring to mostly Christian Palestinian Arabs who lived there, buying water from tank trucks at highly inflated rates, the lawns were green in the settlement, the Jewish settlement. Sprinklers were going at midday in the hot August sunshine. Sounds of children swimming in the outdoor pool added to the unreality. Betty Jane Bailey, The Link. Fascinating. More on the effects of the Israeli occupation. This from Dr. Samir Quota, Director of Research for the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, quoted in the Journal of Palestine Studies, summer 1996, page 84. Quote, "You have to remember that 90% of children 2 years old or more have experienced some, many, many times, the Israeli army breaking into the home, beating relatives, destroying things. Many were beaten themselves, had bones broken, were shot, tear gassed, and had these things happen to siblings and neighbors. The emotional aspect of the child is affected by the lack of security. He needs to feel safe. We see the consequences later if he does not. In our research, we have found that children who are exposed to trauma tend to be more extreme in their behaviors and later in their political beliefs." Dr. Samir Quota, in the Journal of Palestine Studies. According to him, 90% of children 2 years old or more have experienced, some many, many times, the Israeli army breaking into the home, beating relatives, destroying things. Many of these children were beaten themselves, had bones broken, shot, etc. And here's another item on the same matter, effects of Israeli occupation. This from, quoted from Edward Said in The Nation in May of 1998, quote, "There is nothing quite like the misery one feels listening to a 35-year-old Palestinian man who has worked 15 years as an illegal day laborer in Israel in order to save up money to build a house for his family, only to be shocked one day upon returning from work to find that the house and all that was in it had been flattened by an Israeli bulldozer. There's nothing quite like the misery one feels listening to that story." Said continues, "When I asked why this was done, the land, after all, was his, I was told that a paper given to him the next day, by an Israeli soldier stated that he had built the structure without a license. Where else in the world are people required to have a license, which is always denied to them, to build on their own property? Jews can build, but never Palestinians. This is apartheid." The words of Ed Said in 1998. "All Jewish settlements and territories occupied in the 1967 war are a direct violation of the Geneva Conventions, which Israel has signed." The words of John Quigley again, Palestine and Israel, a challenge to justice. "The Geneva Convention requires an occupying power to change the existing order as little as possible during its tenure," the tenure of the occupying power. "One aspect of this obligation is that it must leave the territory to the people it finds there. It may not bring its own people to populate the territory. This prohibition is found in the Convention's Article 49, which states, "The occupying power shall not deport or transfer parts of its own civilian population into the territory it occupies." Plain and simple, fully legal under international law, agreed to by member states, by conciliatory agreement among the states. That's all there is to that. Here are several excerpts from the United States, from the U.S. State Department's reports during the First Intifada. Following are some experts from the U.S. State Department's country reports on human rights practices from 1988 to 1991. This would be the First Intifada. 1988, quote, "Many avoidable deaths and injuries were caused because Israeli soldiers frequently used gunfire in situations that did not present mortal danger to troops." IDF troops, IDF stands for, if you can stomach this, Israeli Defense Forces. IDF troops used clubs to break limbs and beat Palestinians who were not directly involved in disturbances nor resisting arrest. At least 13 Palestinians have been reported to have died from the beatings. 1989, the State Department reported that 304 Palestinians were killed by Israelis in 1989, 304, including 11 by Israeli settlers and 10 by beatings during interrogation, back in 89. 1990, human rights groups charged that the plainclothes security personnel acted as death squads who killed Palestinian activists without warning after they had surrendered or after they had been subdued. I'm going to read it again. 1990, human rights groups charged that the plainclothes security personnel, Israeli security personnel, acted as death squads who killed Palestinian activists without warning after they had surrendered or after they had been subdued. 1991, the report added that human rights groups had published detailed, credible reports of torture, abuse, and mistreatment of Palestinian detainees in prisons and detention centers. All of those instances quoted by former Congressman Paul Findlay from Deliberate Deceptions. Paul Findlay is the author of a book entitled They Dared to Speak Out, or They Dare to Speak Out. Israel and People Confront, I can't quite remember the subtitle, but basically it's They Dare to Speak Out. People and Institution confront Israel's Occupation, or Israel's Lobby, or something. And that's one of the books that I read, the half dozen or so books that I have read on this program. Go to radio4all.net, radio4all.net, type Mideast Migraines into the search box and find episodes of They Dare to Speak Out, which I shortened in the title subsequently to, let's see, TD, the number 2, SO, They Dare to Speak Out. One of my favorite books of all time, frankly. Mainly, not only because of the extensive research and the horrible atrocities that Congressman Findlay uncovered, but he did such a daring, courageous thing to write the book. Okay, next item here. Finishing off this section on the 67 war and Israeli occupation. Jerusalem, eternal, indivisible capital of Israel? Question mark. This from Alan Brownfield in the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, May of 2000. Writing in Jerusalem Report, February 28, 2000, Leslie Susser points out that the current boundaries were drawn after the Six-Day War. Responsibility for drawing those lines fell to Central Command Chief Rehavan Ze'evi, Central Command Chief Rehavan Ze'evi. The line he drew, quote, took in not only the 5 square kilometers of Arab East Jerusalem, but also 65 square kilometers of surrounding open country and villages, most of which never had any municipal link to Jerusalem. Overnight, they became part of Israel's eternal and indivisible capital. Okay. Leslie. Okay, that would be a quarter till. We're getting close to the end of our program here.